All right, get ready for a deep dive. This one takes us on a real trip through legal history. We're looking at Spano v. New York, a 1959 Supreme Court case that changed how we think about confessions in criminal cases. Like, imagine being accused of something serious. You get a lawyer, you're ready to face the consequences.
Yeah.
But then the police, well, they decide to bend the rules a little.
What makes Spano so interesting is that it really shows this turning point in American law.
Right.
The court started looking closely at how police interrogations were happening. And this was before Miranda rights, so things were much less clear back then.
So paint us a picture. Who was this Vincent Spano, and what got him into all this legal trouble?
Vincent Spano, he was a 25-year-old guy who got into a fight with a tragic ending.
Okay.
He killed a man. Spano knew he was in serious trouble, so he did the smart thing. Got a lawyer and turned himself into the police. And his lawyer's advice, the classic, don't say a word.
So far, it seems pretty straightforward. Get a lawyer, stay quiet, let the legal process do its thing. But I'm guessing it didn't go that smoothly.
Oh, not at all. Instead of respecting Spano's right to stay silent and have his lawyer there, the police, they went on an 8-hour interrogation spree.
8 hours.
8 hours. They wouldn't let him talk to his attorney, and they even brought in Spano's childhood friend, who was also a police officer, to try and manipulate him emotionally.
Hold on, they used his friend. That seems like they're using his personal relationships to get what they want.
Exactly. They were hoping Spano would crack under the emotional pressure, and sadly, it worked. After hours of this pressure and feeling betrayed by someone he trusted, Spano confessed to the crime.
So they had their confession. The police probably thought they had their man. Case closed, right?
Well, Spano was indicted for first-degree murder, and that confession became the heart of the prosecution's case. He was found guilty, sentenced to death. The New York Court of Appeals, they even upheld the conviction. Seemed like it was over.
But there's a twist coming, right?
Yeah.
Enter the Supreme Court.
You got it. The Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, overturned Spano's conviction. And this is why Spano v. New York is such a landmark case.
Okay, I need you to break this down. Why would they throw out a conviction that seemed so solid?
The court realized that, yes, Spano confessed, but the way they got that confession was a huge problem. The long interrogation, not letting him see his lawyer, using his friend, they saw this as violating Spano's 14th Amendment right to due process.
So due process, is that different from the Fifth Amendment, the right not to incriminate yourself that we always hear about?
You're right to ask that those two often get mixed up. The Fifth Amendment is about not being forced to testify against yourself. Due process is bigger. It's about making sure all government actions are fair. In Spano's case, the court said the police actions were so unfair that they violated his due process no matter what he said during questioning.
So even if someone confesses and it's true, it could still be thrown out if the police didn't get it fairly.
That's the point. A confession isn't some automatic win for the prosecution. Courts have to look at everything surrounding that confession, the totality of the circumstances, to see if it was truly voluntary.
Makes sense. Stops law enforcement from taking shortcuts or using unethical tactics just to get that confession.
Exactly. It puts the focus on making sure a confession is truly genuine, not something forced out of someone under pressure.
Now, I know the Supreme Court was unanimous in its decision, but I read there were some interesting concurring opinions. Can you tell us more about those?
Absolutely. Justice Stewart, with Justices Douglas and Brennan agreeing, wrote a concurring opinion focused on not letting Spano have a lawyer during questioning. They argued that once someone is indicted and has a lawyer, any questioning without that lawyer present is just plain unfair and goes against the Sixth Amendment right to counsel.
So they were taking a stronger stance on the right to counsel during interrogation.
Yes, they saw this as a fundamental right that couldn't just be ignored because the police felt they had a strong case.
What about Justice Douglas's concurring opinion? I heard he had a different focus.
Justice Douglas was really bothered by the secrecy of Spano's interrogation. He called it a secret inquisition and said it went against the idea of a public trial, which is guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. He felt that these closed-door interrogations create too much opportunity for abuse and coercion.
So Justice Douglas saw this case as having bigger implications for the right to a fair trial, not just this one confession.
Exactly. He was raising concerns about transparency and making sure the entire legal process is fair and open from start to finish.
We were just talking about the Supreme Court throwing out Spano's conviction and those really interesting concurring opinions about the right to counsel and the whole issue of secret interrogations.
Yeah.
It's amazing to see how this one case, Spano v. New York, really started to change how we think about police interrogations.
It really shows you how powerful Supreme Court decisions can be.
Right.
Spano might not be as famous as Miranda, but it really laid the foundation for so many of the protections we just take for granted now.
Speaking of Miranda, we know Spano happened before those famous warnings came about. Can you walk us through what the legal landscape looked like back then when it came to police questioning?
Well, back in 1959, the idea of due process was still developing. The courts were trying to figure out how to balance effective law enforcement with protecting individual rights. There weren't any clear rules about when a confession could actually be used in court.
So it sounds like Spano was a turning point. What kind of message did it send to law enforcement about how they should be handling interrogations?
Spano was a wake-up call for the whole system. It told police they couldn't just rely on confessions that were basically forced out of people, you know, through pressure, manipulation, or denying them a lawyer. The court said loud and clear, the way you get a confession matters just as much as the confession itself.
So just getting the suspect to say, I did it, wasn't enough anymore.
Right, exactly.
The police had to prove they got that confession fairly and without coercion.
Exactly. Spano forced law enforcement to really look at their interrogation techniques and start thinking about how to get confessions in a way that respects the Constitution.
We've mentioned Miranda v. Arizona a few times already, but I'd love to hear more about how Spano directly influenced that landmark case.
Well, you see, Spano was a crucial step towards Miranda.
Okay.
It highlighted this inherent power imbalance you have between the police and the suspect during an interrogation. The court realized how easy it was for suspects, especially those who are young, inexperienced, or under pressure, to be pushed into confessing to things they didn't actually do.
So Spano basically showed the Supreme Court that there needed to be clearer guidelines, like some safeguards in place to protect suspects during questioning.
That's it. Miranda took the principles established in Spano and turned them into those specific warnings that we're all familiar with. The right to remain silent, the right to an attorney. These are basic parts of the interrogation process now.
It's amazing how one case can build on another and lead to such huge changes in the law.
It is, isn't it? It shows how interconnected our legal system really is.
Okay, we've talked about Spano's influence on Miranda, but what other lasting impact did this case have on the legal world?
Well, Spano also solidified the importance of what we call the totality of the circumstances test when deciding if a confession was truly voluntary.
Can you remind us what that test is all about?
Sure. The totality of the circumstances test means the court has to look at everything surrounding a confession, not just one specific thing, like, was the suspect interrogated for too long?
Right.
Were they denied food or sleep? Were they tricked or threatened? Were they prevented from seeing their lawyer? All these factors help paint a picture of whether the confession was truly voluntary.
So it's a much more thorough and nuanced way to judge the validity of a confession than just looking for one major red flag, like a blatant threat.
That's exactly why it's so important. It acknowledges that coercion can take many forms, some of them very subtle. The court needs to consider the entire context to determine if a confession was given freely and knowingly.
So Spano really pushed the courts to take a broader, more contextual view of confessions.
Yes, and that approach is still used today. The totality of the circumstances test is a fundamental part of how confessions are evaluated in courtrooms all across the country.
It's amazing how Spano, a case from way back in the 1950s, still impacts legal proceedings even today.
That's the power of legal precedent. Spano didn't just set a rule for one case, it helped create a framework for how confessions should be handled in all future cases.
We've talked about Spano's impact on legal precedent, but I'm also curious about its practical influence. Did it actually change how police conduct interrogations?
Oh, absolutely. Spano, along with other cases from around that time like Messiah and Escobedo, really served as a wake-up call for law enforcement.
I see.
It showed them that people were watching their interrogation tactics and that coerced confessions wouldn't be accepted anymore.
So it wasn't just about keeping bad confessions out of court, but actually changing how police operate.
Exactly. Spano played a role in shifting the culture of policing by emphasizing that respecting constitutional rights is non-negotiable, even during a criminal investigation.
So thanks to Spano and other cases, there's been a push towards more ethical and legally sound interrogation techniques.
Precisely. And that's good for everyone. For the suspects whose rights are being protected, for the fairness of the justice system, and for the police officers who want to make sure their investigations are done right.
It's incredible how far we've come since Spano was decided. Back then, it was kind of like the Wild West when it came to police interrogations. But now, those rights are much more clearly defined and enforced.
We've definitely made progress, but it's important to remember that we can't let our guard down. The legal landscape is always changing, and we need to keep a close eye on police practices to make sure the rights of suspects are protected.
Well said. This has been a really insightful look at Spano v. New York and its impact on the legal system and police practices. But before we move on to part three of our deep dive into Spano v. New York, are there any key takeaways you want to leave our listeners with?
I think the most important thing to remember is that Spano helped bring about a time of greater awareness and protection of individual rights during interrogations.
It's like that famous line from the Spano decision itself. The police must obey the law while enforcing it.
Exactly. Nobody's above the law, including law enforcement. And that's a principle that still guides our legal system today.
Well put. Now, I think it's time to move on to part three of our deep dive into Spano v. New York. We've explored the case itself, the historical context, and its lasting impact on the law and police practices. So we've really gone deep into Spano v. New York, its historical context, and how it changed the law and police practices. Now, I want to talk about some of the more complex issues surrounding confessions, considering all we've learned from Spano.
This is where it gets really fascinating, even a bit disturbing. Even with Spano and Miranda setting up important safeguards, false confessions still happen.
Yeah, that's troubling. You'd think with Miranda rights, that wouldn't be an issue anymore.
But I've heard of cases where people confessed even after being read their rights. How does that even happen?
It's a question that's baffled legal experts and psychologists for ages. There's no simple answer. What we do know is that false confessions come from a mix of factors, some psychological, some due to interrogation tactics, and some because of the person's vulnerabilities.
Let's break that down. What are some of those psychological things that might lead someone to confess to something they didn't do?
Put yourself in the situation. You're being interrogated. You're in a small, unfamiliar room, maybe tired, definitely stressed.
Right.
The people questioning you are authority figures, trained to get information, and they might be convinced you're guilty. In that kind of setting, even subtle psychological pressure can have a huge impact. So it's not just about physical force or threats. The whole environment, the power dynamic, the psychological pressure, all of that can lead to a false confession.
Exactly. Some people, under intense questioning, start to doubt their own memories. They might even convince themselves that they blacked out or forgot about committing the crime.
Wow.
Others might confess just to get out of that stressful situation, even if they know they're innocent.
It's like a survival instinct. When the pressure's that high, confessing seems like the only way to escape.
That's a good way to put it. And then there are the interrogation tactics themselves, some of which can increase the likelihood of false confessions.
What are some of those tactics that we should be aware of?
Well, some common ones include downplaying how serious the crime is, suggesting that confessing is the best way to get a later sentence, or even presenting fake evidence to make the person feel trapped.
That last one is scary. Imagine being told there's DNA evidence, even though you know you weren't there. It would be so hard to maintain your innocence when faced with what seems like undeniable proof.
It is. That tactic plays on people's doubts and weaknesses. And sadly, it can be really effective, especially with people who are young, have intellectual disabilities, or are easily intimidated.
So even with Miranda rights, there's still a risk of false confessions.
Absolutely. Miranda was a big step in the right direction, but it's not perfect. False confessions are a complex problem, and we need to be constantly vigilant and keep working on reforms to make sure innocent people aren't convicted based on unreliable confessions.
Let's talk about those reform efforts. What are some of the ideas and discussions happening right now to address this problem of false confessions?
One of the biggest debates is about recording police interrogations. Some places have made it a requirement to record the entire process from beginning to end, while others still rely on written summaries or just partial recordings.
Recording the whole thing seems like the best solution. It would give a clear, objective record of what happened, protecting both the suspect and the officers involved.
It seems that way, doesn't it? Many people advocating for criminal justice reform say that recording everything is crucial for transparency and accountability. It allows judges and juries to see exactly how the confession was obtained, whether any pressure was used, and if the suspect's rights were respected.
But I imagine some people are against this idea.
There is some pushback. Some law enforcement agencies say that recording might make suspects hesitant to talk openly. They also worry about the logistics and costs of recording and storing all those interrogations.
It's about finding a balance between transparency and the practical needs of law enforcement.
Precisely. And this debate is still going on, which just shows how complicated it is to find solutions that protect both individual rights and the effectiveness of law enforcement.
What are some other reforms being discussed?
There's growing interest in training officers in more evidence-based interrogation techniques that focus on getting truthful information, not just a confession.
So moving away from psychological pressure and manipulation and focusing on techniques that encourage the suspect to be truthful.
That's the goal. This approach, often called investigative interviewing, emphasizes building rapport with the suspect, asking open-ended questions, and gathering information rather than pushing for a confession.
That sounds like a big change in how police are trained and how they operate.
It would be. That's why many advocates are pushing for standardized training programs that use the latest research on interrogation and false confessions. They believe that better training is crucial for both protecting the justice system and the rights of suspects.
This deep dive into Spano v. New York has been really enlightening. We've explored the case itself, but also its wider implications for how we think about confessions, interrogations, and that tricky balance between individual rights and public safety.
It reminds us that the legal landscape never stops changing. Spano, even though it was decided over six decades ago, still shapes these crucial debates and shows us that the pursuit of justice needs constant vigilance and a dedication to ongoing reform.
That's a great point. Before we wrap up, any final thoughts for our listeners?
I want to stress that false confessions aren't just a hypothetical problem. They've actually led to innocent people being wrongly convicted. We need to keep raising awareness about what can cause these false confessions and push for changes that will make our justice system more trustworthy and fair.
That's a powerful message to end on. Spano v. New York might be a case from the past, but its lessons are still important today. It reminds us that the pursuit of justice has to go hand in hand with respecting individual rights and making sure innocent people are protected. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into Spano v. New York.